We all know how the West was won, with rugged individualism, a bold and daring approach to the new frontier, and a fierce belief in personal liberty and independence. But that does not describe the West, or more specifically, America any longer. We've traded individualism for collectivism, risk-taking for easy handouts, and liberty for Big Brother. My guest today, Axel Kaiser, makes the case against leftist ideology, why America is the last glimmer of hope in the world, and how a basic understanding of economics could free us all. Today, we talk about public debt and entitlement, whether the leftist ideology that permeates our culture is based in ignorance, stupidity, or malice, why the meritocracy isn't a representation of power hierarchies, which a lot of people like to say, and how if we continue down this path, we may see a new age of darkness.
You're a man of action. You live life to the fullest, embrace your fears, and boldly charge your own path. When life knocks you down, you get back up one more time, every time. You are not easily deterred or defeated. Rugged, resilient, strong. This is your life. This is who you are. This is who you will become. At the end of the day, and after all is said and done, you can call yourself a man.
Gentlemen, what is going on today? My name is Ryan Mickler. I'm the host and the founder of the Order a Man podcast and movement. Welcome here today and welcome back. If you're joining me for the very first time, this is a good one to join us on because this is a powerful representation of what we talk about here. And although some people might believe this is political, I think this has a lot to do with what it means to be a good man and how we can begin to reshape our culture and society in a way that not just serves us as individuals, but our families, our communities, our country, and everybody that we absolutely can, the people that we care about. So glad you're tuning in. Before we get into the meat of the discussion, I do want to share that I've got some good friends and show sponsors over at Montana Knife Company. I've been breaking down some meat this weekend. In fact, I used one of their brand new culinary knives, not only to break down meat, but to cut my daughter's birthday cake. And it performed without any incident. So whether you're cutting an ice cream cake for your 10-year-old daughter, or you're breaking down the axis deer you just shot in Hawaii, or you're going to be out in the field hunting later this year, in the next couple of months, and you need a great knife, look no further than Montana Knife Company. You can check that out at montanaknifecompany.com. 100% made in America, doing great things in Montana. And I think you'll be very, very happy and pleased with the knives they create. All right, guys, let me introduce you to my guest. His name is Axel Kaiser. He is a Chilean German lawyer with a master's in investments, commerce, and arbitration, a master of arts, and a doctor of philosophy from the University of Heidelberg, Germany. This guy is absolutely incredible. He's been a visiting scholar at Stanford University Hoover's Institution. He's also a best-selling author of his latest book, The Street Economist, which we talk a little bit about today. And he's also won several international prizes for his writings. His opinions have been published in international media such as the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Forbes.com, Newsweek, the Washington Examiner. These are just to name a few. And in 2021, there was a study published by the Johns Hopkins University Institute for Applied Economics, which placed him third among the influencers on economic matters with the greatest global impact in Latin America, Spain, and the United States. So this is a man who's well-versed in economics and also the signs of the times and what is happening, not just with economics, but culture as a whole. Enjoy this one, guys. Axel, what's going on? Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
No, thank you very much for the invitation.
Yeah, I was glad that you reached out because I've seen your work. I've read a little bit of your book. I haven't gotten through the whole thing, but this is a constant pain point for me. The ignorance around economics, the ignorance around how money works, how value is driven, who gets to determine value. And I was going through your book and going through your work. I'm like, okay, finally, here's an individual who gets it and can explain it in a way that is easy for us to understand and consume if we didn't spend any amount of time in the financial industry like I have in the past. So your work is invaluable.
Yeah, thank you very much. I wrote this book, with the aim of having accessible material for people so that they can understand basic economic principles. And that's because I've seen in Latin America how populism and socialism feeds from this ignorance. People don't understand really basic economic ideas, like what are prices, for example, how do they form, what is capital, how is capital created, and so on. So I wrote this book, 15 Lessons. It's called The Street Economist, 15 Lessons in Economics. Everyone should know. It's a very short book. It has no footnotes, and it has no, you know, math or graphs or anything like that. So it's very easy to understand, and it has been a huge success in many countries.
Yeah, the only thing that would have been better for me if there were more pictures. But outside of that, this is my speed, and it's all, like I said, so easy to understand.
Yeah, but you know, it has been very popular among the youth, which is really important to me, because if you see surveys, polls, like even in the United States, socialism is becoming more and more popular among Gen Zers and, you know, people who are at school or university or universities, not only in the United States, but also in Latin America or in Europe. So now it's being published in different European countries, even in Germany. It has been a huge success in Germany, but also in different Latin American countries and Spain and so on. So I think the aim of the book, which was to make it easy for people to understand economics, has been achieved. And, you know, it's from all social classes. It's very interesting because it's not elitist guys coming from out from the university wanting to understand economics. It's the taxi driver, you know, it's the, you know, the delivery guy, everyone, I mean, from different social circumstances, they are reading the book, and that makes me very happy. And it has been a huge best-selling book.
Let's talk about socialism. Let's define that term first before we get into the weeds and the nitty-gritty of what that means and what it looks like and why it has become increasingly popular among younger generations. The way I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that socialism is basically, in a way, the control over the means by which products and goods and services are produced and then distributed through a government entity based on people's needs, not necessarily the meritocracy that we somewhat live in right now.
Yeah, so socialism in economic terms, this is the classic definition, is the control by the state over the means of production, right? But now I would suggest something a little bit different. It's and it has more to do with philosophy than merely with economics. It has a lot to do with economics, but it's really a collectivist mindset. It's the idea that individualism is wrong, that pursuing your own happiness and trying to help others, you know, in voluntary arrangements, it's a problem. And therefore, you have to collectivize property, and you have to collectivize more and more the fruits of people's labor. And so socialism today means a lot of government redistribution, a lot of government intervention. And so the product of your labor is socialized, basically, because if you are paying taxes, as you are paying in Europe, sometimes you're paying 60, 70% of your income in taxes. If you add everything, put everything together, then really you are not working for yourself or your family. You're working for the government, and they spend the money as they see fit. So I would suggest that socialism nowadays, there are not many people who really propose the Soviet Union style of economic system. They what they want is to confiscate what private individuals can create. And in some cases, like Latin America, you have, you know, a more straightforward brand of socialism, which is government taking over crucial companies like mining, the mining sector, like natural resources and things like that. It's what you have in Venezuela, for instance, right? So then you have the whole progressive part with deconstruction and the woke movement. And that is also mixed with this anti-capitalist mindset, which is very antithetical to all the ideals that were foundational to the United States, for example. So that's what I would say socialism is today, a little bit different from the classic version, right?
It's interesting that you're talking about that collectivist mindset, because on one hand you're talking about it with this growth of socialism, but on the other hand, there's really a pervasive idea in the United States, and I'm sure across much of the Western world, that it's all about the idolization of self. So you have people saying, you know, they're like the transgender movement, I think, is a great example of that. We're no longer going to fit into these clearly identified biological windows or labels, as they like to say. And instead, we're going to say that I feel this way, therefore I am. And it's become an idolization of self rather than the collective agreement or understanding of, in this case, how biology works. So on one hand, in this idea of socialism, you have this idea that it's not about self, but then societally, it really has become about self, and all the institutions of the Western world are being systematically and painfully dismantled.
I fully agree, but you know, the main difference is we classical liberals or conservatives, we believe in the individual. Even some social democrats like Bill Maher, for instance, right? They are not so much the woke thing, but we believe in the individual as a reality. What does it mean that we believe that there is a truth, and part of that truth is that we exist as individuals. That means we have concrete circumstances, like you are male or female, and we believe in reason. That means we can use arguments based in logic and evidence in order to make our case. And we believe in fundamental rights like liberty and life and all of that, right? And the problem with the woke movement, and we have to remember this, is that it is an offspring of neo-Marxist ideologies like the French postmodern tradition and the Frankfurt School in Germany. And so the main idea within the woke movement is that that truth doesn't exist. Everything is about power. So it's narratives competing in order to dominate certain groups like white heterosexual straight men. I mean, of course, straight men create narratives that would marginalize all other groups. And therefore, if, for instance, you say Shakespeare was a great writer, what you are saying is that you are marginalizing all other writers who are not a white, straight, upper class, Western civilization type of white men, right? And so the problem with the woke movement is because they don't have an idea of objective truth. It's all about your own feelings and nothing else. And they destroy the individual as a practical reality. They deny that the individual does exist in the sense that there is some reality beyond your feelings, your perceptions, or the ideas you have in your mind. And that relativism, it's core to every totalitarian ideology. If you go to Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia, it was exactly the same. And that was one of Karl Popper's, the great philosopher of science in the 20th century. He criticized these ideologies for being relativistic in nature. And they deny the existence of truth in order to impose the truth that they want and that serves their interest and their their aim of having more and more power in their own hands. And so it's a very deep a debate that you can have about these issues, because they have a long history in philosophy. And unfortunately, you are seeing now the West going down the drain because of these relativistic ideologies are taking over all the institutions. And that's why you can't claim that the West is better than other civilizations. You can't claim that there are intrinsically positive things about the West. And you cannot claim that there is any sort of hierarchy or superiority about anything, because all that there is power structures and narratives and that have been created by the white guys in order to oppress everyone else. And you only can sustain that if you deny the existence of truth. Because if you admit that there is truth, then you have to accept that some things are better than others, because you have an objective standard in order to measure if something is better than the other thing, right? And if some cultures are than others, and if some ideas are better, and so on and so forth. So that, I would say, is the main difference between what we argue what we classical liberals defend as an individual, and what they argue is an individual. They as I said, they deny the existence of the individual and go to a point where it's a mere creation of their imagination, like they were in the Matrix or something like that. It's not really a serious philosophy, but it's very contagious.
The power dynamics is a really interesting argument. For example, someone listening to this podcast might conclude, if they fall under this ideology, that I have some level of power because I have access to this podcast or access to guests like yourself, or I'm somewhat influential with the people who would listen. And I'm on a micro scale compared to other companies and organizations out there, but I'm just using this as an example. But what's interesting about it is that if I let that so-called power go to my head, or I start losing my ability to add value, and that's one of the concepts you talk about in your book, is who determines value, if I understand correctly. So if I lose perceived value in the eye of the consumer, that so-called power that I had goes away. I'm no longer as influential as I once was. So the power is not really there. The power is with the 8 billion people collectively on the planet deciding what is valuable and what they're willing to trade or pay for goods and services. But I'm always fascinated with individuals who buy into this power hierarchy. And in order to replace the power dynamics and structures they believe exist, they're willing to trade it to an all-powerful, all-benevolent government that has proven throughout time and history to squash and trample individuals way quicker and with much more brutality than any organization or corporate company on the planet. I don't understand why it's okay that the government does it because they're, you know, benevolent.
Yeah, you know, Ludwig von Mises, the great Austrian economist, used to speak about this, and he defined this worldview as statolatry, right? It's a sort of religion that that you embrace and makes you believe that the government, the state, is going to somehow solve all problems, and it's going to, you know, elevate society to higher degrees of moral standing and economic prosperity, which is of course nonsense, because there is no such thing as government or the state. There are groups of people who have certain privileges and the monopoly of violence. That's what we call the state, and politicians, and they have their own agendas and their own, and they also pursue their own interests, but with our money. And then we have the regular citizens who have to pay taxes in order to support all of that and fund all of these people. And this is one of the things I explain in the book. Value is created by the entrepreneurs and, you know, business people only insofar as they are satisfying demands and needs from the consumers and the regular people. I mean, there is zero chance that you can become rich in a capitalist society or a free market if you don't come up with some idea that people value, because no one is going to buy it. And so you will go broke. And you have every day thousands of companies that are going broke, you know, from large corporations to small enterprises. And so it's a big misconception to think that, for instance, even your income is determined by the generosity of your employer. That's not the case. And there is no power. Bill Gates has no power over us, because he's much wealthier than we are. I mean, and astronomically wealthier than we are. So why not? Because we have something called human capital, right? If Bill Gates came to you and told you, okay, now you work for me for $500 per month, you would say, no chance. I will not do that, because I mean, I have alternatives, right? In the free market, I can go and make 10,000, 20,000 a month, whatever. And so Bill Gates has no power over you. He will have to go to the MIT engineers and pay what they are demanding in the market, even though he is much wealthier. So this idea that wealthy people have power because they have money, it's a complete misconception. And the only way they can have real power is by colluding with the politicians, because then they have the compulsory apparatus of the state that can make, you know, laws that benefit them and give them privileges and all sorts of subsidies. And that's when you have crony capitalism, which is the opposite to free market capitalism.
That's what people conflate, right? They say, well, capitalism is bad. It's like, well, tell me what about capitalism is wrong? And they'll explain crony capitalism. I'm like, I agree. That is horrible. You know, whether it's big pharma or we even see this in tech spaces and social media spaces with all sorts of revelations showing that the Department of Justice and other departments within the federal government have colluded with big tech companies to suppress certain platforms, certain thoughts and concepts. That has nothing to do with capitalism. That's crony capitalism. And that's actually what we're suggesting people want more of? That's a confusing concept to me.
Yeah, but that's exactly, you know, that happens because people really don't know a lot about economics. And that's why I wrote the book, The Street Economist, because if people understood like how prices work, how productivity is determined, what is capital and things like that, they would never endorse this worldview that the government is the solution for our problems and that, you know, capitalism is the same as crony capitalism. A free market system is by definition free. You have some rules like private property and others, and then you have to compete. And you have to compete in order to collaborate with your consumers, which is another myth that, you know, that the system is cruel because you are only competing and then it's so inhuman and so on. No, a free market is a system where people compete. Yes, companies compete, but in order to collaborate with the consumers, you have Toyota competing, you know, with Mazda or Subaru or whatever. But in order for you to have a better car that is cheaper, right? Or now Tesla with other companies making electric vehicles. So, so it's the best system that has ever existed, and we are corrupting it more and more with huge government spending, with huge government interventions everywhere. And the United States, unfortunately, is not an example. And I see many resemblances to what's going on in Latin America. I mean, I'm very worried about the United States. If they don't go back to their free market, if you want, Jeffersonian type of ideas, with small government, no? Jefferson was bragging about the fact that he had shrunk the government when he was a president, and at the time the government was minimal; it didn't exist practically, and he was pretty much against the idea of expanding the powers of government. And now you have this ideology proposing that the government has to intervene everywhere, and on top of that you have the woke movement, which is a sort of totalitarian ideology that is, you know, corrupting everything from the humanities, which are completely lost, I would say, to hard sciences. You can't even do physics now without having concern for diversity in your team, if the results will offend or not certain groups, and so on and so forth. This is insane. What's going on? It's really the decline of the West, and I'm very worried about this.
We see. One of the most recent things, I think, to your point in the news is this frivolous lawsuit against, I believe it's against SpaceX, because SpaceX has not hired enough asylum seekers or, you know, foreign nationals. And so now SpaceX is being sued, and it's no longer about the product, the rockets and the propulsion and the innovation and the adaptation that you talk about in the book. And now it's more, well, what does your workforce look like? And that has nothing to do necessarily with creating a better product that's going to get us to the moon or space exploration or Mars or even advancements in technology that we as consumers will use in our everyday lives.
Absolutely. You know, the problem is that, you know, the United States it's a nation that was founded on the idea of moral equality. That means that everyone, all men are created equal, basically. That means we have the same rights, yeah? And so the natural outcome of that is institutional arrangements that guarantee equality before the law, equal treatment, right? But the problem is that in order to have a free society, you need to believe that the important unit is the individual and not collective groups. So you are an individual with your own character, and I judge you, but I can judge you by the content of your character and your actions. But the woke movement, what has achieved is to convince many people that the important thing is that, I mean, the color of your skin, your genitalia, your whatever, you know, your sexual orientation, all of those things. And why did they do that? Because they have fallen into what is called identity politics. The politics of identity means that you create certain groups that have contingent qualities like the color of the skin, sexual orientations, what I just explained, and you conceive them as being in existential opposition with other groups. So straights against gays, and then white people against all the rest, and so on. And when you have this worldview institutionalized, you cannot have equality before the law. And so SpaceX can't really hire people anymore based on their qualifications and their merits, because that would assume that you are evaluating people for their abilities and not for the color of their skin, their social condition, their background, and so on. And that's incompatible with the expectations of an identitarian sort of mindset, which would tell you, you need to have women, you need to have black people, you need to have Latinos, and so on. And it's a never-ending story, because you can always go further, you know, down the road and say, why don't you have overweighted people in your team? And then all institutions become politicized, and then they don't serve the purpose that they have been created to for, which is in the case of SpaceX, you know, to get to Mars or whatever. They become tools for power agenda, which is promoted by the left. And it has to do with this forced diversity, forced inclusion, which is everything but real diversity and real inclusion, because they celebrate the color of your skin as long as you don't vote for Trump, right? I mean, if you think differently from everyone else, then you are also not invited, despite the fact that you are a black or Latino or something like you know, a minority. And so diversity is okay as long as everyone thinks the same. And you see that in universities, you see that everywhere. And that's why I claim that the West is in decline, because everything from sports to classical music and companies has become politicized, and they have been corrupted by this agenda. That's what I was saying, right? Yeah. If you have a laboratory at university in Harvard, let's say at Harvard, and you don't have enough women, like, you have a problem. They're not giving you the funds. They're not giving you money for research, because now that's a requirement if you want to get funds. But what makes you think that because you have more diversity in your lab in terms of biological diversity,
gender, for example, right?
Gender, that would make it a better place to discover anything. Like is it cells are going to reveal themselves, easier? Have two women and one guy looking at them? I don't think so. So this is complete nonsense, but is having disastrous effect all over the institutions, public and private institutions.
Well, I mean, part of it is just speaking out of both sides of your mouth. What do they call it? 1984 double speak, right? It's like
double think. Yeah, Orwell with the having two contradictory ideas at the same time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a double thing.
Yeah, so here's one right here. You mentioned it yourself. Having enough women, for example, at a university in order to secure grants. Well, the same people that would say you need more women can't even tell me what a woman is. They can say that one person can define themselves as a woman one day, and the next day define themselves as a pansexual kangaroo or something. It's like, well, how are you going to tell me you need more women, but you can't even tell me what an actual woman is? Like, that's speaking out of both sides of your mouth. And, you know, at this point, I can't help but think it's only one of three things. It's either ignorance, just being dumb, or being malicious. And I don't know that we can do anything about being dumb or malicious. Ignorance, sure, we can educate. But outside of that, it has me very concerned. You've mentioned multiple times that you're concerned for the future of the West, specifically the United States. What does this look like in your mind if we continue down with our identity politics and with our economic catastrophes? What does this actually look like in reality if we continue down this path?
I wouldn't rule out in the future, if this continues, a civil war in the United States, because you know, the last time in the US, I mean, you had this this fight for the soul of the nation was in the American Civil War, which was really the idea that, you know, slavery was incompatible with the promises made by the founding fathers.
I think most people would agree with.
Of course, it's absolutely true. There's no question about that. But now you have this totalitarian left woke people telling you that the idea of equality before the law, which is, you know, what the Civil War was about, it was equality before the law, equality for everyone, is racist in itself, in its essence. It's a part of the narrative and the power structure created by white men in order to marginalize the rest. And how do they demonstrate this? Well, they tell you, look at the numbers of African Americans who are, you know, being very left behind. I mean, who are being left behind or so, and they tell you that's because of systemic racism. And how do you fix systemic racism, which is baked into the Constitution, into the traditional institutions in the United States? Well, you have to make a revolution. That's basically what you have to do. You have to get away with the American Constitution. You have to get away with the idea of equality before the law. You have to start introducing all of these, of course, affirmative actions, which are already old in the United States. That's not a recent thing. But now you are having universities that are, you know, dropping the GREs or, you know, standardized tests in order to have more inclusion. And then you have people fighting each other. You had the Asian American community suing Harvard because they are being discriminated massively against in order to favor Latinos and Black people. This is a disgrace. This is not the spirit of the United States. So I can easily imagine that if everything becomes politicized at some point, people will want to have their country back, and others will want to destroy it. Yeah, on the left, and that's really dangerous to me. If the Democratic Party does not react against this woke nonsense and starts becoming more reasonable, then I believe that the reaction will be also much more aggressive, and at some point you will have a national crisis, and that's the worst scenario that you can. It's a nightmare, basically.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, millions of people will die if that's the case. I've thought about that with regards to civil war, and I think some of the cases against it are, you know, what does that even look like geographically? You take the civil war, and it was essentially drawn north versus south, right? But that doesn't take place today. That's different. I mean, my neighbor, you know, could be a leftist, and I could be ultra conservative, or vice versa, and so we're so intermingled and intertwined that I don't think there's a clearly defined geographical line where that civil war takes place, which has me wondering. I don't know that you're wrong. I just wonder what that actually would look like because of how mixed we are geographically.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure, but if you take a look at the voting records in the United States, you can see that Democrats are winning in the coast, basically. And
true. Yeah.
Cities and all the rest is basically red. So there is a huge divide between the elites and the urban type of population and the rest of the American citizens. And it's so, the mindset is so different that you can have someone like Hillary saying these people are all deplorables, right? And then you have the arrogance of the coast elites telling them that they are all racist and xenophobes and this and that, and of course that's not really helping. And then you have, for instance, someone who has studied this in great detail, which is the sociologist Charles Murray. He wrote this book Coming Apart, and you can see that in the United States you have now a huge divide that had never happened before in terms of social classes, in terms of ideas, in terms of values, in terms of everything. And so even in terms of politics, people are trying to move to places where they don't find people who think differently anymore. I mean, of course, you have everywhere Republicans and Democrats, and that's for sure. But if you take a look at the large numbers, I know many people who have left California because they don't like the politics of the place, and they don't like to be surrounded by these inquisitors who are, you know, trying to cancel you all the time. And I'm sure there are millions of cases like that. If I had to move to the United States, and I'm in the process of probably doing so, I would move to Florida, where I'm right now, because I can't really express my free opinion if I was living in New York among the elites there, or in California, in LA, or something like, unless I'm in a very close circle of friends. And so this totalitarian mindset of the woke movement, I think, of course, is creating a reaction against it, which is also strong. And it will make it more difficult to live together. And I've seen this idea. I don't remember which politician proposed it, but like, let's end the union and have Democrats living in some states and Republicans living in other states. It's happening naturally, I think. And the question is, can you sustain the union in the long run if you have such divisions? I'm not sure.
All right, man, I'm going to take a break from the conversation very quickly. I got to ask, are you feeling stuck? I mean, I talk with hundreds, if not thousands of men each and every week. And I can tell you with 100% certainty that many of them are feeling trapped and stuck in horrible relationships, dead-end jobs, and basically just a life of complacency and mediocrity. Unfortunately, way too many of these men attempt to pull themselves out of the waking nightmare they found themselves in, but that doesn't work. It's impossible to pull yourself out of a place that you currently are. And what you need is someone else from a different perspective on sure footing to offer a hand so that you can begin to change your current reality. And that is what we do inside of our Brotherhood of Men. We work together to help each other out. We don't offer handouts because that doesn't help either. We offer hand ups. And that means that you're going to have to work as hard, if not harder, than the man who is working to serve you. So if you're ready to put in the work and just need an assist along the way, we have a proven framework and a solid network of men who will band with you along the way. So I'd invite you to join us in less than 10 days in the Iron Council. And you can do that at orderaman.com/Iron Council. Again, orderaman.com/Iron Council. Do that right after the show. For now, let's get back to it with Axel. Yeah, I don't think it's possible at the rate that we're going. You know, we've talked a lot about different political ideologies that fall outside of the scope of economics, but you chose to write this book and you study a lot on economics, especially these 15 principles that people can apply. Is part of the reason, and I don't want to lead you at all, but I'm wondering if part of the reason is because this is the entry point to helping people understand and then it permeates other facets of our lives, or is it just a small piece of the puzzle that's separate from other areas that we also need to address?
I think it's a crucial part of the battle against tyranny and against ever-growing governments, because I'm absolutely convinced that economic, illiteracy is the main reason why people, or one of the main reasons why people tend to support big government politicians and populists and socialists and demagogues. And
are you saying so because those individuals, you said economic literacy, but
illiteracy,
some of the wealthiest people on the planet support these insane ideologies. So I'm not sure if it's economic literacy.
And we can't forget that socialism was invented by the elites, just like communism. And communism and socialism is more or less the same. And fascism. That's true. And that deserves an explanation. But I think it has to do with the fact that many wealthy people, and I know some, do not necessarily understand economics. No. Like, if you ride a bike, that doesn't mean that you know the physics laws that enable you to ride the bike. So many people have made a lot of money, and some feel guilty because they have a lot of money, and so they start supporting BLM or other NGOs that promote really very, very toxic ideologies. And so that's
more
part
like
of
virtue
it.
Signaling virtue response.
It has to do a lot with virtue signaling. And this is the classic case with Hollywood stars who are communists and Marxists and live in their $30 million LA mansions, you know, which is a completely hypocritical thing to do.
Of course.
But if they speak about inequality and they support people like Chavez, you know, Oliver Stone working Chavez. And so it's really insane, but this is nothing new in history. I mean, we had Felix Weil, who was a very rich German guy who started the Institut für Sozialwissenschaft in Germany, which it was basically created in order to transform Germany in the 1920s into a Marxist communist state. And that's the epicenter for many of the ideas that you have right now in the United States, because also a lot of these thinkers like Herbert Marcuse and Theodor Adorno and Horkheimer and others came to the United States. When the Nazis came to power, they fled to the United States and brought their ideas with them. And so this is critical theory. This comes from the Frankfurt School, and is this cultural Marxism, basically, that took over universities a year later, and also with the help of the French thinkers like Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida. And this, my point is that these people were funded by very wealthy George Soros type of tycoons, right? And one could ask oneself, why is George Soros funding so many destructive initiatives? And in his case, I don't think it's ignorance. In his case, I think he's really much a person who hates the West.
It's malicious, sure.
Malicious. I think it's evil, right? And that does exist. I mean, if you study the history of communism, it was evil. It was really, truly evil. And many people, fell for this thing. And they endorsed it and they supported it, and many rich people did that. Even people from the Catholic Church and others. Our Pope, the Pope that we have now, the Catholic Church, he's a communist. I mean, he's socialist. He said that the true Christians were the communists. He actually said that. And so you have these ideologies, these worldviews, these religions that can really ruin everything. And then it doesn't matter if you are wealthy or not. You will have people from all social conditions that will want to endorse these things. And also, as you said, because of virtue signaling, it's really convenient. So you don't get your privileges examined very, carefully by the woke mob. To endorse some woke causes and say, oh, I care so much about diversity. Or you have, Megan Fox having all her children being trans. I mean, what are the odds? Three children and the three of them are trans? I mean, this is pure virtue signaling. This is pure, I'm so cool. Yeah, I go with this trend and I'm better than the rest. And this need to prove that you are morally superior to others, it's intoxicating. And enables you to cancel the rest because you claim you are a better person, not only, more famous or wealthier. You're also a better person. That gives you the right to shut everyone else down. So, yeah, it's a very complex situation. And I think if the reaction is not really strong, there is no way that we are going to save our hemisphere, and the United States is the key battleground. If we lose the US, we lose the whole world.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's also an inherent danger in speaking up and speaking out. You know, there you will be shunned, you will be doxxed, you will be canceled, you will be hurt in the wallet, sometimes even violently. I think about with regards to your comments about transgenderism, there's the author Abigail Schreier with the book Irreversible Damage. You know, that like she took so much criticism, so much heat, and that book has just been blasted for credible work that's supported scientifically, and yet it cannot be tolerated because it goes against these ideologies.
Yeah, that's why I say this is a totalitarian movement. We have to be very careful, because at the essence of every totalitarian movement, you have, epistemic relativism. That means the idea that there is no objective truth. And so science doesn't matter anymore, because it's not about arguments based on reason and logic and evidence. It's about power. And it's only about that. And so I've read the book. I think it's a great book. And we have to say these things. I mean, recently, Richard Dawkins, with whom I have had, you know, long conversations a couple of years ago, was also claiming that biological sex is real and that you can be polite and, of course, you know, treat someone who believes who is a woman and being a biological male as a woman. You can do that. But what you can't do is to deny the underlying biological reality. And this pretense that there is no objective reality is the problem. Because we could agree that, I mean, let's be nice and kind and don't really be aggressive towards people or unpolite, you know, with people who believe there are something different. Okay, that's one thing. But it's also your right not to accept it. But you can, we could agree on that, yeah? But what is really the problem is that is this claim that there is no objective reality, that everything is a construction of the mind, basically, and the self does not exist. Because in order for you to create a self, right, you have to exist first. So you cannot create a self ex nihilo out of nothing. You know what I mean? So this idea is also idiotic, because you have to exist as an individual in order to have an identity. You can't have an identity before you are an individual. And if you're an individual, a member of a human species, you have a head, you have bones, you have cells, and you have chromosomes, right? And you can be male or female. That's it. There is no other alternative. I mean, there are some cases, okay, but as a general rule,
those are medical anomalies. That does not represent a separate class or gender or sex of an individual.
Absolutely. But my point is, you cannot define and say I'm a woman, right? Because you already exist before you have claimed that you are a woman. And that means you are a reality that is independent from your thoughts, your thoughts about yourself, right? I could claim I'm black, but I'm not black, right? I mean, it's the same thing. Or that I'm 15 years old and I'm not 15 years old. And actually, this deconstruction, because that's the word that was used in philosophy, in the French philosophy, postmodernist, mindset, the deconstruction of the structures leads to chaos. And that's why now you are seeing all this chaos in women's sport, for instance. And now there are some states and countries and organizations that are banning trans men from women's competitions. Because of course, if you allow trans athletes, then you will have chaos within the female communities, athlete communities. They will not be able to win anything else anymore. And then it will collapse. Because which women will want to go and compete against biological males, right? I mean, if this becomes a trend, no one will want to do that.
Yeah, of course.
And then you have men claiming to be babies, grown-ups. Have you seen that?
No, I don't doubt that, but I haven't seen that.
Yeah, they're claiming like 50-year-old men dressed, I mean, with diapers and dressed like babies, claiming that they are babies and they perceive themselves, you know, as babies. And now I was in Puerto Rico recently giving some lectures, and I was told that there was a student, it was a schoolboy or girl, I don't remember exactly, but who believed to be a cat. And she went to school, I think it was like 12 years old or 10, dressed with a cat type of costume. And the other children were forced into accepting her as a cat. Like, imagine the confusion that creates in your mind. as a child, and the professor, the teachers were okay with it. I don't know what the parents were thinking, but
well, they weren't.
they were not thinking, but I think it's also criminal because you have to you have to give children a clear message and clear standards, because they are not capable of doing the sophisticated analysis that we grown-ups can. That's why, for instance, fairy tales have these very clear ideas of good and evil. There are no gray areas. It's black and white, right? Because children need that. They are not in a position to do this more nuanced approach and to have this, you know.
Most adults aren't capable of doing it.
Exactly. But that's why, and they are also destroying fairy tales. I mean, you know, Snow White now with Disney, the last production that they're doing right now, it's a complete perversion of the original Grimm's tale. Sure. It has nothing to do with the original. And I tell you, I grew up in a German family, so I know about this stuff. And it's really harming also children, because you are depriving them of a source of knowledge that is very useful for them in order to develop a strong sense of morality. And fairy tales help you do that. But if you start woking it up, then you lose it. You lose it. It's perverted. And maybe you achieve the opposite.
I think of like fairy, you know, like Hansel and Gretel, right? And it's like, you teach a kid, don't go with strangers into the forest. That's probably a good principle that kids should know. But all of a sudden, if you know, the witch is painted as a victim, and, you know, she's actually a good person, but she lures kids into, you know, because she's a pedophile, and that's normalized. Well, that might be an issue for kids to hear that and think that that's acceptable and okay.
Well, you know, pedophilia is actually a big thing, and it's coming back into fashion. In the 60s.
I hate the way you said that. And I'm not criticizing you. It just the way that is said is just so it's horrific. It's horrific.
Yeah, but you know, it's a natural result of this woke ideology, because if you really believe that there is no objective truth and that all social norms are just forms of discourse that you know, have the aim of exerting oppression by some groups of people over other groups of people, then the idea that that sex can only happen between consenting adults is in itself nothing else than a form of narrative that is competing against other narratives in order to consolidate the power of certain type of people, which are, you know, straight, white, or not even necessarily white, but straight adults. And so the pedophiles are being discriminated and oppressed, you know, if you follow this logic. And so now you don't call them pedophiles anymore. You call them minor attracted person.
Yep.
In order to normalize it. But this is really interesting, because one of the main philosophers and thinkers that developed this idea, who was Michel Foucault, was himself a pedophile. He would go, he was a French intellectual, very famous in the 60s, 70s, even 80s. He was homosexual who would go to Africa, to Morocco, and he would pay children to have sex with him, poor African children, and he would take them to a cemetery, and he would have sex with them in the cemetery, and he developed the theory that the medical establishment had nothing. I mean, he had developed a sort of narrative in order to control people's lives, people like himself, who also ended up in a mental institution at some point. And he took this to such an extreme that he criticized the message given by the medical community to the homosexual community to use, you know, protection when they had sex in order to prevent the spread of AIDS. And he said this was just another form of exerting power over them and discriminating against them. And he died of AIDS in the end. Mm. So this is completely irrational. This is completely insane. And this is the same philosophy that you are seeing right now advancing at schools and media and other parts, sexualizing minors, not only in the US, also in Latin America and Europe. And Europe has a very dark past with this. Like Germany would have, in the 70s, experiments with children where the parents, and this is insane, like, you know, when people say, what are the parents thinking? Like, they're not thinking. Well, it was the same in the 60s and 70s in Germany. They would have kindergartens where they would, and these were all educated people coming out from universities. I mean, only people coming out from universities would do something like this, I think, where they would sexualize children and bring them to have sex between them and also with adults. And they would question if it was a good idea to have sex with their own children. Because, you know, I mean, that was the point of lunacy of this whole ideology. Because once you get rid of the objective standards, objective truth of anything, or as a concept, what is the limit, right? If sexuality is nothing but a convention, why can't you have sex with your own children? It's like, who created this convention? Ah, is the bourgeois society, the white, straight men who want to criminalize and marginalize the rest of people who are not like them. That's the concept. And they even signed a letter, Michel Foucault, Simone de Beauvoir, who is the mother of all feminists, right? And from the whole queer movement today, even, defending pedophiles that were arrested in France in 1977 for having had sex with children. And they signed a letter, all of these French intellectuals, dozens of them, all of them rock stars at the time, defending these people and claiming or arguing for the abolishment of consenting laws, of the, you know, laws demanding that, you know, you have to be 17 or 18 or whatever in order to have sex with someone. And this is gaining traction again. It's insane.
Yeah. What are, like, with regard, we've talked a lot about the issues, and I think, you know, shedding light on these subjects, because it can't exist in darkness if more people are talking about this. I mean, you're talking a lot about it with your research, with your book, with economics specifically with regards to the book, but is the solution to then just continue to talk about this, bring this to light, be vocal about it? And I would say be as vocal and active as the social activists are. There's got to be a way to combat this, and it has to be with doing things vocally, enacting legislation, running for office, like all the things that we can do. What are some of those suggestions that you would have?
I mean, this is a battle of ideas, and it's a battle for the minds and hearts of people. And I strongly recommend, if the you know, viewers of your show have the time, to read Antonio Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci was the founder of the Communist Italian Party in the 1920s, and he was the most lethal Marxist intellectual in the 20th century. And he said that what you had to do was to take over institutions, to take over schools, churches, and universities, and media, and so on, because it was not about the violent revolution. Against Lenin and Marx, he argued, it's not so much about the violent revolution. It's about changing people, how people think, their minds. And that you can achieve if you engage in what he called cultural hegemony. And you create a discourse that is so dominant in the public and private sphere even, that convinces so many people that capitalism is wrong, and that, you know, the institutions, the bourgeois institutions, have to be overthrown, that the system will collapse by itself once you destroy its legitimacy in people's minds. And that's exactly what they did with the long march through the institutions. And they took over universities. And I think that's the origin of the crisis, that we lost the universities, and they are now controlled by bureaucrats and professors who have these totalitarian tendencies. And then you go to Harvard or Stanford or whatever, and then you go to other positions of influence in the media, in Disney companies, and then the effect, the influence of these ideas go far beyond the Department of Humanities at the universities and sciences. Now everyone is forced to take some training, microaggression training courses at Stanford, for instance. This is insane. And it becomes, and this is very important, it becomes part of the general culture at some point, because the humanities, you know, tend to be relatively useless if you want to get a job and you have a degree in philosophy or literature or whatever. It's not very good if you have that. It's better to have engineering, an engineering degree. But the fact is that the humanities define the soul of a nation. All the questions about morality, what is wrong and what is right, are not scientific questions. These are philosophical questions. And a culture reinforces the answers to these questions through movies, through literature, through philosophical books.
Entertainment,
music, all of that. Need this art, of course. You need the group of people who are thinking about these issues, who are mostly at universities, not only, but mostly at universities, to give credit to these ideas and to develop these ideas. And the West is basically a philosophical achievement. The idea of the individual, which emerged from Christianity, yeah, that we deserve equal rights, which is in the Declaration of Independence in the United States. This is what made this civilization so prosperous. And so when you lose the humanities, you lose the fight, you lose the battle, because you lose the case for what you consider is good, for what we view as good, and what we consider evil becomes what most people, or a lot of people, consider appropriate. That's why I think it's so dangerous when you start saying, oh, Shakespeare, he was just a representative of the bourgeois class and the white heterosexual oppression of everyone else, which is what, by the way, are teaching you at many universities. So they can tell you, you know, any, you know, African-American writer or Indian or Latino writer is as good as Shakespeare. There is no hierarchy. It's all a social construction. Yeah, to make you feel more inclusive. Okay, everyone can be like Shakespeare. It's not true. Shakespeare is superior to everyone else. But you cannot make that claim if you don't believe there is a truth, an objective standard for measurement, right?
Yeah.
So that's the problem with universities. And I would encourage everyone who is giving money to universities, and I recently talked to one who is a big donor at one of the Ivy League schools. I told him, don't give them more money. I mean, why do they continue supporting the destruction of the United States and the American, you know, they called it an experiment, but it's a very successful one. And it's now being attacked from everywhere. Like you have also the rivalry with China, you have Russia, but the main problem is inside. It's the people trying to undermine it from the inside, and the Colin Kaepernicks of the world, and all of these guys who would claim that the flag represents something immoral,
which is, I mean, so it's lunacy. It's so ironic. An individual like that, who's been the recipient and beneficiary of this amazing, incredible social experiment, would basically spit and stomp all over the very thing that allowed him to progress the way that he has.
Yeah, and as I mean, he's you know, a sports person. He's very famous. But where did he get these ideas? Because Martin Luther King didn't think like that. He was very much an admirer of the founding fathers, and he was claiming, you know, the promises they made in the Declaration of Independence, in the Constitution, they have not been fulfilled for everyone. So let's move forward with this. But they would say, like Frederick Douglass, they would claim and argue that, you know, that these were great ideas. But Colin Kaepernick comes now and say, and says, no, you know, this is an oppressive system. This is horrible. The flag is represents, you know, oppression and slavery. This is completely absurd. And it's completely against what Luther King and Frederick Douglass, who actually did something for Black people in the United States, right, would argue. I mean, they would be happy to see the huge progress that has been made over the last century in this country, even over the last decades. And there is no society with more freedom and more respect for individual rights, I think, than the United States, and more diverse at the same time. And so I think it's very, I mean, sometimes I get a little angry because I grew up in Latin America. I know what failed nations look like. And I travel all over Latin America, you know, giving conferences and lectures, and also Europe. But I mean, the United States is the place everyone wants to go. Why is that? and it's not because it's evil. It's because you have better opportunities in it is a better place than the rest of the world. That's a reality. And I'm not even an American. I'm saying that because I know it's true, right? The city upon a hill, when John Winthrop came with the settlers here to, it is a city upon a hill. And we all admire the United States. And if we lose the United States, we will not even have a reference point for the rest of the world. Mm. And that will be a new age of darkness, a horrible one, because I don't think we can solve the vacuum with China or Russia or India or, you know, in Switzerland, it's too small for that. So, yeah.
Well, Axel, I appreciate all of your efforts and all of your work and your conversation with me today. I mean, all of this is so enlightening. I actually expected the conversation would take a different track, talking more specifically about economics, but I'm really glad that we went down this route because such needed conversations. And guys can always go pick up a copy of the book and read the book on their own, you know, so which I would highly suggest they do. And you talk about it being a pinnacle component of the entire conversation that we're having here. Why don't you let the guys know as we wind things down, where to go, where to connect with you, where to learn more about what you're up to, and of course, pick up a copy of the book as well.
Yes, so the book is on Amazon and it has been recommended by some of the best economists in the United States. So I'm very happy. Like Deirdre McCloskey, Casey Mulligan at Chicago University, and many others. And they can buy it there. And also at the website of Republic Books, they can find it. I have an Instagram, which is at Axel Kaiser B. It's Kaiser with like Kaiser Permanente. It's the same spelling. And Axel with E, not with like Axel Rose. It doesn't have an E. It's a Axel with E and B from Barents, which is my second last name. And also at Twitter, I am at Axel Kaiser. And so they can follow me on social media and I'd be happy if they make some comments about the book there.
Awesome. Well, we'll sync everything up. Again, appreciate your work and all the efforts you're putting forth. Hopefully this gets into some ears that need to hear it and we can start to turn the tide, so to speak. I appreciate you. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Ryan.
All right, there you go, guys. My conversation with Axel Kaiser. I hope you enjoyed it. We talked a little bit about his book and a lot about other issues, but many of them needed to be talked about. And I'm glad I get to do that with someone who is such as well-versed as Axel Wood. I would highly encourage you to follow him over on social media with the hundreds of thousands of other people who are following along with his mission and his work. Check out his book, which is called The Street Economist. And also take a screenshot and tag him, tag myself. Let everybody know what you're listening to. Guys, if we're going to change the tide of this culture, whether we're just talking about masculinity in general, or we're talking about economics or whatever it may be, then what we have to do is begin to speak up. And we have to share what we know, share what we're learning, share the resources that we have. And I'm asking you to share this resource with other men who are in your corner, who want to learn, who want to grow, who want to get better. All right. That's my ask of you. Also, make sure you check out the Iron Council, which opens up September 15th. So we're about 10 days out. And you can check that out at orderaman.com/ironcouncil. I'm going to send an email the night before we open to those of you who want to be notified so you can get in there before anybody else. And you can do that again at orderaman.com/ironcouncil. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed the conversation. If there's other conversations you want me to have, whether it's an interview with a certain person,
or a Friday Field Notes, where it's just me, or questions that you have, hit me up on Instagram at Ryan Mickler. Send me an email, ryan@orderamand.com, and continue to share. All right, guys, we'll be back tomorrow for our Ask Me Anything. Until then, go out there, take action, and let's all become the men we are meant to be.
Thank you for listening to the Order of Man podcast. If you're ready to take charge of your life and be more of the man you were meant to be, we invite you to join the Order at orderofman.com.